Thursday, March 5th. This morning, Lyndon went to New York to Mrs. Robert Wagner's funeral. I did not go. I felt like I was letting him down, letting him endure something painful and hard without me being there to share it, which, in some way, does it relieve it, sharing it? But I had not been close to her, and it would take a great bite out of a day that was already fulfilled, leaving over to tomorrow other things that would be hard to fit in. So this morning, I had a fitting, and then I had a long, long conference with Jim Webb of NASA about the trip to the space installations. It all boils down to this. He thinks the one to Huntsville can be well and constructively handled in a natural fashion. He foresees extreme difficulties in the ones in Mississippi and Louisiana, particularly in Mississippi, close to the town of Picayune, where really it's just the bare beginnings of a space installation. What's there now is bulldozers and dug up earth and confusion. When the land was condemned by the government and the people had to move out, it made a great many of the landowners mad. So instead of being a boon to the community at present, it's a bone of contention. Also, some of the towns close by that had hoped to get the families to beef up their economy, their payrolls, their general way of life, have applied for government help in such things as sewers, expanded schools, roads. They've been turned down on every application because of the integration problem, or so they think. And so there's more pain and trouble right there now than there is happiness over the NASA installation. And then when you get on to the one out from New Orleans, this installation is not actually under the control of NASA. It has been leased to, I think, Chrysler Corporation. So it all boils down to more difficulties than I think I want to walk into. That is, except the one at Huntsville. I had lunch in my room, a session with Mr. Ketchum in which I learned about the family dining room on the second floor. And we carried a lot of paintings around and decided where we were going to hang some and what others we were going to return. And then there was a perfectly hilarious session of picture taking with Linda and Lucy on what may turn out to be a cover for Look on Mother's Day. Poor Lucy looked more and more wooden and couldn't get her head close to Linda's and mine and couldn't smile, and everybody kept on saying, "But Lucy, smile." And she got more and more hysterical and said, "How can you put on? How can you smile if you don't feel like smiling?" I felt so sorry for her. I didn't know what to do. I must find somebody, a sort of drama teacher, because that little girl is prettier than either Linda or me, and she doesn't come across in pictures as well as she should. A color picture is her chance because her complexion is so radiant and her eyes and hair so pretty. But she doesn't turn the light on inside. That animation, that spirit that is so much a part of Lucy just comes to a dead halt when faced with a camera. Tonight is the night of the fifth in our series of receptions for the House members. Only 127 this time. Lyndon was on time immediately to meet them, and we began in the Blue Room at 6 o'clock. There was an unusually large number of Texas members this time. Bob Casey, the Jake Pickles from Austin, who had wanted to be here particularly so that they could be with the Homer Thornberrys, the Graham Purcells, that humorous Walter Rogers, and how I would love to stop and listen to hear him make a report on the finances of the club, and, I must add, Bruce Alger. And I felt a little flicker when he came down the line, and I very dignified and composed said hello to him. It was necessary to remind myself that this is the business of all the Congress. Veteran Mrs. Frances Bolton was there, and a good congresswoman she's been for a long time, Lyndon thinks. And Carrie Davis of Tennessee, it was so nice to look around and see her, because she's carried a load for women in this town more than anybody, with the exception of Lindy Boggs. And there were the Hurlongs, whom I remember from my long-ago happy family vacation trip to Florida. Well, just about the only time, I think, that all four Johnsons, no, not the only, one of the few, that all four of us went off on a gay, silly family vacation together. And there was handsome young Ogden Reed, Republican of New York, whose family controlled such a sizable amount of that newspaper. And also handsome Roman Pachinski, whom I remember from our trip to Illinois, when we met all the Czechs in Chicago, I think. And the Neil Stablers of Michigan. I'll never see them without remembering that night in the hotel in Detroit in October of 61 during the Cuba crisis, when the president made his speech and when you didn't quite know whether you were going to wake up the next morning to a living world or wake up the next morning at all. And Basil Whitener of North Carolina, whom I remember from a much happier sort of day, just a real rural campaigning day in North Carolina. The men had an unusually good briefing. It must have been because it was so long. The ladies and I did all the surveying of family rooms and official rooms on the second floor that we wanted to, and then we still beat them down to the east room where the buffet table was spread out by about 10 minutes. Usually they had time just for almost immediate coincidence. Here are several of the things that I remember with pleasure from that evening. We were talking about how different families had used the house and the changes that had taken place in it, and one of the congressional wives turned to Carrie Davis and said, Carrie, what was it like in this room back in the, I forget what administration she said. And Carrie sort of smiled and said, I don't know. I've been here 32 years and I've never been upstairs before. And then while we were dancing, one of the congressmen said to me, this is the first night I have felt important here. Usually, I just feel like a cipher because there are so many of us. The dancing was fun, and I got handed around from congressman to congressman. It's sort of nice being the belle of the ball without having to earn it. But at least I might be able to earn it because I'm certainly getting to be a better dancer from practice. When everybody had departed about 9 o'clock, we went to the pool with the thornberries and the pickles, because nothing further can happen to my hair. It's had it, and I'm going to the beauty parlor in the morning, and so I knew I could have the luxury of swimming up and down about 20 times in this warm water. And besides, I regret all the times I don't share it with Lyndon, this swimming. It's just that I cannot afford the hours and the money at the beauty parlor. It's been such fun to have the thornberries here. Not exactly stimulating, but so pleasant and happy and true, and so very restful for Lyndon. But that does remind me of what has been the most stimulating hour of the day. Lyndon had asked Helen Gehagen Douglas to come home from the banquet the night before, spend the night with us. He had supplied her, apparently, with my nightgown and robe, and there she was on the third floor. So, at breakfast, I called her to come down and in her robe, my robe, and have breakfast with me in my room while we watched Lyndon depart by helicopter from the South Lawn for the funeral. There's a line of poetry I wish I could remember to apply to Helen. It's something about time does not stale, nor age something, thy infinite variety. And she is, indeed, still the same vivid person I knew back in 1939, 40, somewhere along then, on up until President Roosevelt's death and her defeat from Congress, 46 or thereabouts. She's an extraordinarily handsome woman with an enormous appetite for life, an encyclopedic accumulation of information, and a regular machine gun way of imparting it, rat-a-tat-tat. I spent a wonderful hour and a half with her, at the end of which I had gotten in probably two dozen words, was exhausted, and had simply loved it. I asked her what she'd been doing. She'd been lecturing on foreign affairs. She'd been taking trips to South America, to Asia. She was going to Russia next. Among the interesting concepts she dropped was that man, who had been floundering around on this planet for an awfully long time, had lived here as more or less of a beast until the first revolution, which was the agricultural revolution, wherein he learned how to use bronze and iron and other tools for agriculture. Many, many eons had elapsed. And then finally, about 1800 or so, came the second revolution, the Industrial Revolution. And then, not quite 200 years later, here comes the third important revolution, automation, which is going, according to Helen, to change the course of our lives, producing more plenty than there has ever been before, more time for leisure, for real intellectual pursuits than there ever has been before. But what's going to happen to poor old human nature that is used to working? And what's going to happen to our Puritan consciences? I guess that's the problem of the next two decades.